Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club, where Richard Marles makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Some of you will recall he was here a few years ago, but he's well known, but I will introduce him briefly. Richard Marles' background as a lawyer was Slater and Gordon. He became Federal Secretary of the Transport Workers Union, Assistant Secretary of the ACTU from 2007. He has been the Minister for Corio in Victoria, around Geelong and other parts. Was a Parliamentary Secretary for Innovation in the Labor government of recent memory, a Parliamentary Secretary for the Pacific Islands, and finally the Minister for Trade. And currently, Richard Marles is, of course, the Shadow Minister for Immigration, and it's on this topic that he's going to address the Sydney Institute tonight, specifically on offshore processing, the way forward. Richard Marles, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jared, and it really is a pleasure to be back here speaking at the Sydney Institute. For 26 years, the Sydney Institute has been a centre for reasoned debate about Australian public policy, and there's really no area where this is needed more than the debate around asylum seekers and Australian immigration. Because in recent years, this debate has been toxic and its impact on modern, multicultural Australia has been damaging. It has been this way for almost 15 years, since 2001, when John Howard used the Tampa affair to stir a hornet's nest of xenophobia, fear and mistrust in the community. And in the process of harnessing and exploiting the sentiment of a shell-shocked public in the aftermath of September 11 terrorist attacks, a wily Prime Minister, quite frankly wrong-footed Labor, and set all of us on a course that until quite recently has required grappling with ugly politics amid an already complex policy debate. Immigration should be a bipartisan issue. The handling of asylum seekers should be a bipartisan issue. But once one party allowed the partisan genie out of the bottle, and a genie at that which appealed to the darkest angels of our nature, it has been very difficult to put it back again. Changing the nature of this debate has been my effective mission statement from the time I became the Shadow Minister for Immigration back in 2013. To do this, it's been Labor's belief that immigration policy cannot be determined by reference to achieving political outcomes, but rather by the values which are common to all of us as Australians. So we need to be wary of policy which lends itself to an election billboard, and instead embrace policy which helps save lives and gives expression to a generous Australian contribution to the world's humanitarian need. So over the last 2 years, Labor has sought to develop policy based on the values of generosity, fairness and compassion. We have measured every step we have taken by asking the question as to whether that step will reduce the sum of global human misery. Accordingly, at the ALP National Conference earlier this year in July, the party engaged in an open and in a frank discussion about what policy settings we would adopt in the next Labor government. Now, the focus of much of the media attention at our national conference was on the issue of whether a Labor government would turn back asylum seeker vessels if safe to do so. And importantly, it was resolved to allow a future Labor government the option of using so-called turnbacks as a part of a broader arsenal of tools to deter vessels from making the perilous journey from Java to Christmas Island. We could have opted to dodge this subject, kicking it down the road and avoiding the difficult conversation and process that followed. However, that would have been more than just an act of political convenience. It would have been an act of policy recklessness that would have been projected into the murky underground world of people smugglers as a glimmer of hope that they could revive their trade in human misery under a future Labor government. That someone in Jakarta, a former people smuggler now driving a taxi because he is out of business, is monitoring Australian politics, waiting for a sign that he can start marketing the deadly journey to desperate people, is sadly not a myth. And it shows that details in this policy area are very much issues of life and death. They are facts that simply cannot be ignored in setting policies in this area. Putting people smugglers out of business is what drove Labor back in 2013 to heed the advice of the expert panel on asylum seekers and put in place the regional resettlement arrangement with Nauru and Papua New Guinea. This actually has been the single most important decision of any Australian government in bringing an end to the journey from Java to Christmas Island. It was a decision that created a circuit breaker by removing any reason for people to embark on unseaworthy vessels and pursue the dangerous and all too often deadly journey that saw some 1,200 men, women and children die on our border. And the fact that we have seen no drownings since 2013 is without doubt a really remarkable accomplishment. Now, in the face of our difficult decisions at National Conference, there were people who were fierce in their criticism of us. Some people responded to our policy decisions by saying that they didn't accept the drownings argument. I have to say that I find this utterly abhorrent. What we saw play out on our border over the last few years was not an argument. It actually did happen. 1,200 people lost their lives, and this can't be ignored just because it doesn't fit comfortably with a particular argument. And other people responded by saying we've simply pushed our problems elsewhere and that asylum seekers are drowning on someone else's watch. This is completely incorrect. Our intelligence agencies and our public servants have good visibility on this, and there is no evidence whatsoever that this has occurred at all. In fact, to the contrary, the evidence is that lives have indeed been saved. And so in parroting these sorts of lines, people are actually refusing to acknowledge that we no longer have our customs and navy personnel facing the morbid task of pulling bodies from the sea. In truth, there is nothing compassionate about people dying at sea. And this was a human tragedy that all of us had to bring to an end. This debate was tough for Labor, but it was a defining moment for Bill Shorten as leader of a modern Labor Party. At the time of dealing with the issue of stopping the journey from Java to Christmas Island, our National Conference was meeting at a moment in history when the world was experiencing its greatest humanitarian need since the Second World War. And if compassion and generosity were to be our guide, then this also demanded that we propose Australia to play a larger role in global humanitarian affairs than we ever have before. And so we announced at the same time that under Labor, Australia's humanitarian intake would increase to 27,000 places, with a portion of that figure dedicated to resettling refugees from our region, an effective doubling of our humanitarian intake. We said that a future Labor government would play a leadership role in building a regional humanitarian framework in Southeast Asia to improve the situation of asylum seekers. And this would see us
supporting the UNHCR in providing health and education services to asylum seekers. It would see us advocating for work rights for asylum seekers, similar to what would have been achieved had the Malaysian arrangement of 2011 been allowed to be implemented. We also promised a dramatic increase in our funding to the UNHCR of $450 million over a four-year period that would take Australia to being one of the top five global contributors to the vital UNHCR work. Now, together, all of that represents the largest offering of any potential Australian government to the world's humanitarian affairs. It is an emphatic statement that under Labor, Australia would take its place among the nations in the world which are at the forefront of providing humanitarian assistance. And it stands in stark contrast, really, to a Conservative government which, by and large, has seen the ending of the journey from Java to Christmas Island not as an act of compassion, but rather as the central piece of an architecture which has been about Australia turning its back on the world. As positive as National Conference was for Federal Labor in establishing a soundly values-based position on asylum seeker and immigration policy, the experience of developing it over the last 2 years has highlighted for me just how much large parts of this debate are irrational and often uninformed. I can't point to any other policy area that is so mired in emotion, misinformation, and at times hysteria. And one where inconvenient facts are cast aside in pursuit of rallying catch cries and platitudes. Both the Liberal government and the Greens Party have been the victors in this arena. The Greens Party has frequently and recklessly perpetuated the notion that detention centres are hotbeds of violence located in nations that are lawless and whose populations are complicit in it. And at the same time, the Liberal government, while Scott Morrison was minister, turned political chest-beating into an arm. A hero of the Daily Telegraph and champion of hardline policy that was at the heart of the Conservative Abbott government. In fact, there was so much zeal within the government for its Stop the Boats policy that Mr Abbott routinely took to the world stage to offer up his policy as some kind of a global panacea. And so sadly it remains the case that the battle for a reasoned debate is still to be won. Having hopefully seen an end to the journey from Java to Christmas Island and having articulated a much greater humanitarian role for Australia within the world, the biggest legacy issue about which all of us should now be concerned is how we are treating the people who have already made the journey and are living in Australian-funded facilities. There are real concerns about the pace at which the 30,000 asylum seekers onshore in Australia are being processed. Labor maintains our opposition to temporary protection visas and the Fast Track Immigration Assessment Authority, which deny those seeking Australia's protection from accessing a robust refugee determination process. But quite apart from the manner in which people are being assessed, the appalling timeliness of this process is leaving tens of thousands within our community in a state of limbo and with ever deteriorating mental health. But an even more pressing issue is the fate of the near 2,000 asylum seekers and refugees who are on Manus Island and Nauru. The future of the detention facilities on Manus Island and Nauru has become the new hotspot of the asylum seeker debate. Now, any sensible consideration of this issue must begin with the role that these facilities have played in bringing an end to the dangerous journey at sea. It is utterly clear that the closing of these facilities or the bringing of any of the asylum seekers to Australia will result in asylum seeker vessels being put on the water once more and people drowning at sea again. Manus Island and Nauru must never be seen as a stopover on the way to Australia. And it is simply intellectually dishonest to advocate for the closure of the facilities on the one hand and not accept the responsibility for the consequences on the other. In fact, those who advocate in this way really deal themselves out of any sensible debate. In pursuit of an agenda of breaking the detention facilities on Nauru and Manus, there are some voices who have spread fantastic claims of misinformation about what is occurring in these places. And much of this is ultimately focused on an appalling characterisation of Nauruans and Manusians as being lawless and dangerous. Of course, crime exists on both islands and in both communities, as it does everywhere in the world. But to assert that Nauruan men are habitually rapists or that Manusians are extremely violent is obviously offensive and obviously bigoted. It bemuses me that people who come to this debate wearing the mantle of compassion can think that it is okay in the pursuit of an agenda to engage in a free-for-all on these island communities. And we are well to remember that if there are two populations in this world to whom Australia has a particular responsibility, it is the Nauruans and Papua New Guineans, because these are the two countries that gained their independence from us. And it is critical in this debate that we do not drift into the space of demeaning peoples who look to us as their global best friend. Of course, having rumour presented as fact is the collateral damage of this government's hopeless lack of transparency over offshore detention facilities. It has created a breeding ground for people to easily cast all facilities as terrible, unsafe and violent. This simply should not be how a modern country like Australia goes about its business. Transparency is the disinfectant of bad policy. We cannot expect the support and confidence of the Australian people in Australian government action if they cannot see that action for themselves. And so a Labor government would seek to negotiate with PNG and Nauru independent oversight of these facilities as an important integrity measure to start rebuilding community confidence in the centres that we as a nation fund. We would make it very clear that all those working within these facilities would be expected to speak out when they see a wrong. We already have introduced a private member's bill into Parliament to make it an offence not to report signs of child abuse where these are observed by those working within the facilities. Perhaps the biggest issue associated with this misinformation is that it distracts from the very real issues surrounding the fate of the asylum seekers and refugees on Manus Island and Nauru. I believe that the Turnbull government has been utterly negligent in its duty of care to the men at the Manus Island facility and the men, women and children at the Australian funded facility on Nauru. The Labor Party's resolve to ensure people do not again die off our shores in pursuit of asylum should not be misjudged as Labor endorsing the way this government operates its offshore processing facilities. There is no legitimate reason why, 2 years after coming to government, this government has thought it acceptable to have asylum seekers in Nauru still housed in tents. When Labor left office, it had planned to finish the construction of the facility on Nauru, which would have seen everyone living in hard-walled facilities. On coming to office, the then Minister for Immigration, Scott Morrison, quickly stopped this work and actively kept people living in tents. Now, earlier this year, I visited the Zaatari refugee camp some 10 kilometres from the Syrian border inside of Jordan. It's run by the UNHCR in cooperation with the Jordanian authorities and provides refuge to more than 80,000 men, women and children fleeing the conflict in Syria. In almost precisely the same time period as the operation of the facility on Nauru, the UNHCR has rolled out hard-walled accommodation which offers dignity in difficult circumstances to a refugee population 80 times the size of that which is on Nauru. The locks on the doors offer safety, privacy and peace of mind. So why did the Australian government leave people languishing in exposed tents? Why has it not demonstrated any sort of willingness to provide humane and safe conditions for the people in these centres? Why has it allowed itself to be so carried away in its fervour for slogans and chest beating that it has ignored the conditions of people looking to us for safety? Everything we now know, and at the time that Minister Morrison made the decision to keep people living in tents, is that to do so will see higher rates of domestic violence and sexual assault. And this is exactly what the Moss Review and Labor's Senate inquiry has ultimately found. And the facility on Manus Island has also been the subject of terrible decisions about conditions for those living within it. We saw a substandard medical facility kept in place for far too long. To be fair, the new medical facility opened in June of this year is unquestionably state-of-the-art, but its opening comes too late for Hamid Kazai, who died as a result of preventable septicemia while receiving care in that old temporary medical clinic put together with shipping containers. Since coming to office, the Turnbull government really has mismanaged Australia's relationship with PNG. Minister Morrison failed to meaningfully engage with the government of Papua New Guinea for most of his time as Immigration Minister. It was months before he had a discussion with his counterpart in PNG about the resettlement of asylum seekers in PNG under the regional resettlement arrangement. It took the death of Reza Barati, an asylum seeker within the Manus facility, for him to launch structured bilateral talks with PNG about this issue. And not surprisingly, the Cornell report into the riots which occurred within the facility found that the most significant problem within the facility was a lack of processing and resettlement. It's only now, more than 2 years after the regional resettlement arrangement was signed, that we are starting to see some signs of resettlement in PNG. Now, the Turnbull government likes to quietly imply that the fault here lies with the PNG government. Yet this, in my mind, is nothing more than backpassing. Let's not forget it was PNG that came to the table and offered to help Australia find a solution to the deaths occurring off our shores. PNG is the one providing Australian help. For this to be a sustainable policy setting, it absolutely requires us to work hand in glove with the PNG government. Where there are areas that need to be improved, we need to demonstrate not just a willingness to have the difficult conversations when they are needed, but actively play a role so the Australian community has confidence Australian-funded facilities are humane and safe. There are many skilled men amongst the asylum seekers on Manus Island who will be able to settle in PNG and secure work in industries like the mining sector, just as many Australians have who work in PNG today. And for these people, PNG remains a perfectly viable resettlement option. But to really resolve the fate of the bulk of asylum seekers on Manus Island and Nauru, there needs to be a credible third country option negotiated by the Australian government. In this, the coalition government has been a signal failure. We've seen the government engage in a scattergun approach that has seen the Liberals spend $55 million to resettle four, now three, refugees in Cambodia. This is an arrangement which we learned more about from the Cambodian government than from our own. And I suppose given the expenditure and low take-up rate, is it any surprise that this is one immigration story the government didn't bring out to the Daily Telegraph? We routinely hear of discussions with foreign governments about resettlement arrangements that never eventuate. We had the Philippines put on the table until that government ruled itself out as a permanent place for resettlement. And only last month, we had the bizarre notion of Kyrgyzstan being floated as a potential resettlement option. Of course, from opposition, Labor does not have the capacity to begin these negotiations in earnest. However, it would be a first order of business for a future Labor government to pursue this. And in doing so, a Labor government would start by working with the UNHCR to seek their input about appropriate and viable third country resettlement arrangements. But in the absence of this step, the government has no real long-term answer as to what will happen to these asylum seekers and refugees. And it is not feasible to see the long-term settlement of 1,000 refugees in Nauru on the existing population of 10,000 on a remote island with few natural resources in the middle of the Pacific. Right now, the economic stimulus associated with the detention facility affords a certain degree of forbearance by the people of Nauru with the burden that they have been asked to shoulder. But once this is diminished, as the detention facility winds down, the consequences of leaving the refugee population on Nauru are enormous. Without resolution, Australia will not only be doing damage to the refugees, but we will be doing damage to an entire country. And on Manus Island, the detrimental consequences for men being housed together over a long period of time away from their families with total uncertainty about their future is self-evident. If the 2,000 people currently living on Nauru and Manus Island are still there in 5 years or even 2 years from now, we as a country would have done them enormous harm. And as a nation, we will have completely abrogated our responsibility to provide safe, humane and dignified refuge to these people. Australia will have added to, not reduced, the sum of global human misery. The next step for the Turnbull government is patently clear. Australia must redefine its relationship with the UNHCR. It is this which will bring our nation in from the cold and offer some sort of hope that sensible conversations can be had about the future of those asylum seekers and refugees on Nauru and Manus Island. It is this which was at the heart of the policy package Labor announced at our national conference back in July. And the need to rebuild the relationship with the UNHCR should not be a surprise to Malcolm Turnbull. From the outset, the coalition have sought to distance itself from the UNHCR and deride the UNHCR as the global custodian of humanitarian affairs. Former Minister Morrison carried as a badge of honour, shutting the door on the UNHCR, saying, and I quote, "Australia's border protection policies are made in Australia, nowhere else." And the former Prime Minister Tony Abbott said, and I quote, "I really think Australians are sick of being lectured to by the United Nations, particularly given that we have stopped the votes." Given the disdain with which they have treated this global body, is it any wonder this government has been forced to go it alone and trade on the edges in trying to desperately secure a resettlement option? Without taking this step of re-engaging with the UNHCR, another human tragedy will play out, this time within the Australian-funded detention facilities on Nauru and Manus Island. The decision in September to take 12,000 Syrian refugees is certainly a step in the right direction. In it, we saw, for the first time in a long time, a hope of the emergence of a new bipartisanship about Australia as a generous nation which engages with the UNHCR. But there remains much work to be done if this hope is to be translated into a reality. And so for Labor, the taking of this step would be our first order of business. And we would invite the Turnbull government to take it with us and join us in a new bipartisanship about asylum seekers and immigration, which lays to rest the terrible debate of the last 15 years for good. Thank you.
Many thanks to Richard Miles for his address tonight on an important topic. So we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than the top of the hour, and if you're making a point, don't stand in front of the camera there. Mr. Miles, towards at the end you concluded with what you would do, the first thing you would do, but as you know, it's about, at this time next year the election will be over, it could be held around this time, it could be held earlier. So if at any time during 2016 you happened to win an election. How would you summarise your first two or three or four or five steps? I mean, how would you, assuming you could get legislation through the Senate, but how would you, what would you start off doing?
Well, thanks, Jared. I think the issue of those, the asylum seekers and refugees on Nauru and Manus, really is the most difficult legacy issue associated with what has played out over the last few years. And it is really difficult. We would make it core business to resolve the fate of those 2,000 people. I don't for a second think that that can be done overnight. But I absolutely do know, as I said in the speech, that the way forward on that is for Australia to start re-engaging with the global community in response in respect of humanitarian affairs. There has been a sense over the last 15 years, which has become particularly acute over the last few, as we've seen the breakdown in Syria, events play out in Yemen, events play out in northern Nigeria with Boko Haram, where the world really is facing its biggest humanitarian needs since the Second World War, and that has been a dramatic increase in the last few years. There is a sense, I think, of pain, to be honest, within the international community, that Australia is not there playing the role that historically we would have been expected to play. And that instead what's happened is there's this kind of bizarre debate going on in Australia, which those internationally find hard to understand. The issue of dealing with dangerous journeys and making difficult decisions in respect of people smugglers is, of course, something that the global community understands and deals with all the time. But it really is the attitude to the UNHCR, the UN system more generally, which has confused people since the life of this government. I have absolutely no doubt that we don't resolve the fate of the 2,000 on Manus and Nauru without the help of the global community. We just won't do it. And that's evident from the way the government's acting. It is seeking to go out and make arrangements, but it is not doing it with the kind of countries that could help us actually resolve their fate. And so we simply have to re-engage, and I think that is, you know, absolutely first order of business. I touched on the issue of the 30,000 who are here onshore. A much larger number, they don't get as much attention because they are within our own community. But they are a silent issue which is also growing in significance, because there has been precious little progress made in processing and assessing this group of people. That needs to happen really with urgency. And of course, people's assessments need to be done in a thorough way, but the new Fast Track Immigration Assessment Authority has been anything but fast track. In fact, what we've seen is a dramatic slowing down in the way in which these people have been processed. And again, what that means is we've got a population of near 30,000 people in our community who are living with enormous uncertainty about what their future holds, and also doing so, by and large, on the public purse. And so that's not efficient either. We need to resolve their fate, and we need to resolve the fate of the 2,000. And that, for me, would be absolutely the first order of business.
There's a question here and then over there. Yeah.
As you know, the majority of South Vietnamese refugees that came to Australia came through camps. And many of us in this room had experience of having them to resettle. I've had a bit to do with Billowood and so forth in the last 20 years, but it puzzles me why, in all the time that we've had detention going back to the Keith government, there's never been a local solution, a regional solution, overshadowed by the UNHCR, to have some sort of centralised settlement or camp or whatever. What is the chance of that happening? I mean, why is it not happening? Okay, there was a crisis in Vietnam, but there's a crisis in the world. It seems to me long overdue.
So I think developing regional resettlement arrangements within Southeast Asia is really important, and it's a very good question. And I think you point to a gap in the global architecture around this. There are questions about the the desire of countries within the region to participate in this. That's not to say that the countries of the region don't want to work in some form, but it is to say that there are sensitive issues that need to be worked through. What is clear is that whilst it is difficult to map out exactly what can be achieved by Australia in this regard, because when you get into the realm of foreign relations, by definition, you're dependent upon decisions of other countries. What is clear is that when Australia has played a leadership role in this regard in the past, as we did through periods of time during the Rudd government, we have been able to have an impact. Right now, I think it's fair to say that the Australian government is playing a leadership role under this government within Southeast Asia in terms of combating transnational crime, and that's important. But in terms of building a humanitarian space, a protection framework such as you've described, this government has absolutely eschewed doing anything in that regard. And when I went to the UNHCR back in April and talked through with them the kinds of ideas that I've expressed with you tonight and formed the basis of our policy announcements back in July, I think if there was anything that was welcomed with open arms, it was the idea that Australia would play a leadership role within Southeast Asia. Now, when you go drill down a bit deeper into that, there's in fact a pretty interesting story going on in Southeast Asia, and again, one where it's really important that we get into the facts and we understand this. If you put the issue of Rohingyas to one side, and it is a big issue, it's certainly the Rohingyas are definitely a group which are the subject of oppression in Myanmar, but if you put them to one side for a moment, the rest of the story in Myanmar is one which is very positive. The UNHCR absolutely expects that the vast bulk of people who are in refugee camps on the Thai-Burma border, who have been there for more than 30 years, are in the next couple of years going to go back to Myanmar. That's a great thing. But it's something about which, or in which, Australia should obviously play a role. It's not going to be easy to take 100,000 people who have been for decades outside of the community and bring them back in. We can help with that. And equally, there are large populations of displaced people within Malaysia. I think we can play a role there. So the scope for Australia to play a role in the emerging and ultimately positive dynamics in respect of the region, I think, is very significant. And I think we can do stuff in respect of the Rohingyas as well, in terms of working with Myanmar about that. But it involves us actually being engaged and wanting to play that role. And I think up until now, whilst the government has been keen to play a role in respect of transnational crime and combating that, when it comes to protection frameworks, they have done nothing.
To what extent is there any substance in the theory that domestic Australian politics in the refugee area is largely influenced by relatively recent migrants who are the electorate in Australia and who resent the notion that there should be a more or less open door policy for others now?
The suggestion is that it's recently arrived migrants in Australia who are putting political pressure on governments and oppositions to have a pretty tough line against asylum seekers.
I think there is lots of politics which has, over the last 15 years, swirled around this area. And that's patently true. We've seen that play out. I think we have seen this issue played hard with political advantage to one side of politics. It is very clear that this is an issue which has played well for Conservative governments. It is an issue which has played very badly for Labor. By the way, it's played pretty well for the Greens as well. I don't think there's any doubt that we have watched politicians in this country whip up political fervour around this issue, and that has been to the detriment of good public policy in this country, but more than that, in whipping up this appalling debate, it really has, I think, torn at the fabric of modern multicultural Australia. And that's a big issue for us, because we are, next to Israel, we have the largest proportion of our population born outside of our borders. You know, for us, for the Australian project, it is utterly essential that we have a positive attitude to multiculturalism in this country. And yet this debate has run at its worst completely contrary to that. You ask specifically in respect of new migrants. I think, let's be clear, I do think that there is a legitimate point that new migrants would have, that having gone through a process, often one which is very lengthy in getting to Australia, they look at what has happened in this regard and have a particular view. But at the end of the day, we also just need to take a step back, all of us, and start analysing this from a values base, which is the point I was really making. I think if I say nothing else about other political parties in this country, but what faces Labor and what we need to do and the challenge that we are faced with, I do think back in the aftermath of 2001, steps were taken by Labor which had at its heart political motive. Which at one level I can understand as a politician very clearly, but the problem with that was it kind of fractured a sense of trust that existed between the parliamentary party then and our base, and we've been wrestling with that lack of or breach of trust ever since. It seems to me, therefore, that responding to this in a political way hasn't worked for us. And at least for us, the way through is just to really do this on the basis of values, generosity, compassion, fairness, as I said, thinking about these issues in terms of what's the right thing to do, measuring every step based on whether we reduce the sum of global human misery. And I reckon in doing that, the good politics will follow. And I think in doing that, we can absolutely explain this issue and get support for our policies from new migrant communities as well. So I've got absolutely no doubt that the politics has played its part and it has put pressure on us in Canberra in terms of how we handle it. But I've also got no doubt that the way through back to a place of bipartisanship on this issue is for us all, and we will start it from the Labor point of view, to analyse this issue and develop policy based on values. That's how we resolve this.
Paul. Yeah, Richard, congratulations on your address. I thought it was excellent. I think you're being a tad disingenuous about how the politics have worked for Labor. I think Rudd did some stupid things in this area that were just mind-blowingly stupid in their terms. But your faith in the UNHCR, and I understand and I largely accept the point you make about the need for us to re-engage with the UNHCR, but your faith in the UNHCR, when you sort of enunciate that there's been no successful structure or architecture in Southeast Asia, you look at what's happening, and they are doing a great job in Jordan and Syria, but you look at there and it's a hideous mess. You look at the Rohingyas, you look at North Africa, you know, it's hard to see where the UNHCR are really a shining light of actual achievement. Would you like to comment on your placing that faith?
Yes. Firstly, just briefly on the comment in relation to the Rudd Gillard era. I've been the first to say that we made mistakes at that time. And I think part of moving forward on the way I've described in terms of making calls on the basis of values is also to own responsibility for what's happened in the past. I might say, you know, there were terrible political decisions made by the Liberals and the Greens in blocking the Malaysian arrangement, for example, which are a large part of the blame, if one wants to apportion it, in respect of what we saw play out on our borders. But there is no question that, in my mind, Labor made mistakes. But I'd also say this. Once we started seeing people dying in the numbers that they were, and this appalling tragedy played out, in Chris Bowen, in Brendan O'Connor, in Tony Burke, the three immigration ministers during that period of time, watching them up close, every morning they went into work with one thing in mind, and it wasn't politics, it was how do we stop this tragedy, and that was the only thing occupying their mind. And ultimately, as I said in the speech, coming up with the regional resettlement arrangement was the critical step, I think, in beginning the process of bringing an end to that terrible tragedy. In terms of the UNHCR, look, we could easily spend the next couple of hours engaging in a critique about all that's wrong with the UNHCR, and it would fill up those 2 hours. But there is a point at which, you know, organising global activity is not simple. You know, the world history is basically replete with the failure of being able to do that. I want to look at this not from the point of view of what they haven't been able to do, but what they have been able to do. I tell you what, you go around the Zaatari refugee camp, you see 80,000, it's the second biggest refugee camp in the world today. You see a population of 80,000 people being housed in hard-walled facilities in a space which just 4 years ago was open fields, where there is a main street with, you know, every shop you can imagine in it, where people are getting access to health facilities, to food, to refuge. And that is being organised by the UNHCR. I'll tell you what, you can't come away with that from that experience without thinking that this is an organisation which is about doing good. I've been to the Dadaab refugee camp in northern Kenya. That's the largest refugee camp in the world. It's a population 3 times the size of urban Geelong. That's the scale of it. More than 400,000 people there. Again, UNHCR and the UN agencies working there, incredible things they do. And I went to a refugee camp called Yido, which is in the top of South Sudan, about 15 k's south of the South Sudan-Sudan border, where there is conflict going on in the southern part of Sudan. There they were seeing, and I witnessed, you know, people coming in hundreds a day. And again, in an area which in the wet season is the biggest swamp in the world, from that has emerged this settlement which is providing refuge. The UNHCR does good work. But Paul, the other point about this is it is the manifestation of the global community. It is where countries come together with all our faults and with all our inadequacies, but at least come together and try our best to resolve the world's problems in terms of humanitarian affairs. And my point is simply this. For the last few years, we've not been there. Australia has not been there. And so when Australia goes to the world as we need to right now and as this government is trying to do and says, hey, listen, we've got a bit of a problem here with the 2,000 people on Nauru and Manus. Is there anyone out there who could help? Well, if we've turned our back on the world, this government should not be surprised that the world has turned its back on it. Well, that's the base proposition here. And so all I'm really saying is, with all its inadequacies, we need to engage with the global community family of nations. And we need to do it meaningfully. And we need to be seen to be playing our part at a time when the world is facing a great humanitarian need. I think that's the most important step that we can take if what we want in return is to have some assistance in respect of this issue which we need. And that's what we need to do.
John, addressing the 30,000 who are still in Australia's unresolved situation and the inertia that appears to be there, do you believe a case could be made for taking refugees and those people seeking asylum out of the hands of the Immigration and Border Protection Department, which is increasingly developing a model of becoming a paramilitary organisation and putting it more into a humanitarian organisation? I mean, in recent days, we've seen a group of nuns in Melbourne prevented from taking children out on excursions to the nearby animal farm when Border Protection says they need to be guarded by proper guards when they go out. And these nuns have been taking them out for several years. And it just seems that there is a mindset within the new Department of Immigration and Border Protection towards criminal penology rather than humanitarian endeavour.
So there's a bit in what you've asked. Let me start off by saying this. In terms of the creation of Australian Border Force, it was actually during our period of time that we put forward the idea of merging customs with immigration so that people would be able to be met by one uniform at the border. Now, we support that as a form of an administratively sensible decision to make. And there's been a lot that's been said about the Australian Border Force in terms of various... there have been lots of assumptions about the management of information and the rest, which I think actually people have been getting wrong. I think it is important, let's put it this way, it is important that the culture of that entity, and this government has called it the Australian Border Force, I'm not sure that's what we would have called it, and this government have given it the uniforms that it has, I'm not sure that's what we would have done, but they've done it in any event. It is very important that this as an organisation is a human organisation. It's really important that we don't see in the Department of Immigration and Border Protection the triumph of border protection over immigration. It's not to say that border protection isn't important. It's, of course, vitally important, and we do face a whole lot of national security threats at the moment, which increases its importance, but so too is the immigration function. And I can remember, when I first got involved in this area, talking with people who've been involved in the Department of Immigration over decades, who speak with passion about the mission of the Department of Immigration since its creation immediately post-Second World War as one of the first departments of immigration anywhere in the world, about core business being the custodian of that journey from the moment of first contact that people have with our country, be it a consulate overseas, be it at our border, be it being rescued, through to, depending on what their status is, becoming a citizen of Australia and working with those people in building modern Australia and seeing immigration as a central, almost the most central lever in building our economy and our society. Like, the notion of immigration as a human department, the notion of immigration as a nation-building department has to be a part of what Australian Border Force is. So I absolutely hear the point you're making, and I really do think that that sort of nation-building side of this needs to be part of its work, as it is the broader Department of Immigration's work. And I guess from that point of view, I am reluctant, therefore, to support notions at the moment which I hear around the place, which essentially seem to me about separating immigration human type functions off the Department of Immigration as an act of kind of running away from Australian Border Force, because if that's where government goes, it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Actually, I think the humanity needs to be put back into these entities, and that's the way we have to go.
Getting close to the end now, there's a question there from Duncan. Yeah.
Touching again on the 30,000 people who are in the country and who are already processing, one of the things I think is of great concern is their mental health, especially Absolutely. Children. What would Labor do differently to address that issue and to ensure that speeding up of processing and attention to mental health issues? And another unrelated question, but what do you think about us trying to get a seat on the
So, what would Labor do differently to address mental health issues, and what's the prospect about Australia getting a seat on the UNHCR?
I think it's the UN Human Rights Council, Rights Commission, which is what you... let's deal with that in a second. Oh, I agree with... I think that's a good thing. I'm a big believer from a foreign policy point of view, in Australia engaging in these councils of the world, and there's a sort of a different argument around that, but as a middle-sized country which needs to plot its path in the world, which is not always that obvious, it's really important that we have a very keen understanding of how the world works, and we get that understanding, we learn about this when we seek a role in those bodies, and having participated in the campaign to have Australia elected to the UNHCR, that was an incredible learning experience for our Department of Foreign Affairs, and the period of being on the UN Security Council was, it helps reinvigorate our sense of how, in detail, the world is working out there. So from that point of view, I think it's very good that we do that. Your principal question, what affects the mental health of people who are seeking asylum more than anything else is uncertainty. You can have people, you can have people living in quite basic conditions, but if they have a sense of what's going to happen to them in the next 3 months, they'll put up with it. But equally, you can have people living in the Hilton, but if they have no idea what's going to happen to them for the next 10 years, they'll go mad. Resolving certainty is the most important thing that needs to happen. That we have seen this government allow 2 years to go by where, in a sense, that cohort have been in the deep freeze for one reason or another is appalling. It really is appalling. We just need to see people being processed as soon as possible. And we had a perfectly good refugee determination system in place, which has been overhauled as an act of zealotry, really, to come up with this fast-tracked Immigration Assessment Authority, which in fact has been anything but. We don't like that authority. We would want to have the system that we've been working with over many years, which works perfectly well and which has at its heart the Refugee Convention in the way in which people are assessed. But most importantly, we would want people to be assessed and to have their situation resolved. And our view is if they are found to be, this cohort of the 30,000 who are already here, if they're found to be genuine refugees, then they should be afforded permanent protection in this country. And if they're not, then they should be facilitated in their return. And it's as simple as that.
Final question, Dennis and Dave.
The Parliament's number one requires about children in detention for that last 25 years. What's your view on children in detention and trying to resolve that?
The issue about children in detention, which is suggested has been an issue for 25 years.
Yeah, so children in detention should be a simple proposition, and that is that growing up behind a fence is no place for a child, and we should be doing everything we can to have children out of detention as soon as humanly possible. Simple as that. There are some issues which need to be considered in that. It's important we're not separating families. And I think in some of the commentary that you see, that is a pretty pertinent fact which people don't think through. A number of, not a large number, but there are a number of people who are in immigration detention who have negative ASIO assessments, where it is the right thing to do, not for national security reasons, not to have those people in the community, but they do have families, and those families are choosing to live with them. I think families being together comes first. People should be given the option, but if people want to stay together as a family, they should be allowed to. And national security considerations obviously form part of that. But in a practical and sensible way, we ought to be doing everything we can to get kids out of detention into the community, and that's in fact what we were doing in government. I mean, the government likes to say that there were thousands of kids in detention now, and now it's only, when we were in power, and now it's only a small number. The real point is this. That is true, but the length of stay that those children had in detention under Labor was actually a short period of time as we found options for them outside of detention. What has happened under this government is there has been a blowout in the time that kids who are in detention have been spending in detention. We need to be, given the provisos I just said before, doing everything we can, and we can do things, to get kids out of detention quickly.
Richard Miles, many thanks.
Thanks, Jared.
I guess one of the most difficult jobs in government in the current environment in Australia is immigration minister, and being shadow immigration minister is also an extremely tough job. So we're very grateful that Richard Miles could come to the Institute tonight and talk about his view on the general issue of asylum seekers, but also set out what, if Labor happens to win the next election, what the shadow minister would do as minister. So it's a very good overview of the problems that Australia is facing and how Labor in opposition is looking at this and what Labor would do in government. So we're very grateful for you to come along tonight. We've got your talk on the podcast. Anne will be publishing your paper in due course. And we've got 648 here tonight on Foxtel to record this important event. So many thanks, and we'll see you back sometime in the future. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.